This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. I want you to be aware this next interview concerns the ethics in deciding when someone is legally dead. It might be hard for some of you to listen to. You might have heard about two Michigan cases involving young people, teens. The first case is Bobby Reyes, a 14-year-old. In that case, the University of Michigan Hospital found Reyes was brain dead. His family worked hard to stop the hospital from taking away life support. His mother, Sarah Jones, spoke with WXYZ-TV.
Because they were going to finish what they started. It's what they've been trying to do since my son got here. They've been trying to kill him.
The other case involves Titus Germain Cromer Jr., a 16-year-old. Beaumont Hospital says he is brain dead. The family disagrees. This is their attorney, Jim Razor, who also spoke with WXYZ-TV.
There are some cases where people who are judged to be brain dead spontaneously awaken. And although that might be a remote chance in this case, it's a chance.
Now, at one time, the standard used to decide if someone was dead was when the heart stopped beating and the person stopped breathing. Today, medical tools can keep the heart beating and the lungs working. So for the past several decades, the standard has been to determine death is the complete and irreversible absence of all brain function. To better understand what all that means, we've asked Thaddeus Mason Pope to join us. He's an expert on medical law and clinical ethics. He's the director of the Health Law Institute at Mitchell Hamlin School of Law in St. Paul, Minnesota, and he joins us by Skype. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So how do medical personnel decide when someone is actually brain dead?
So brain death has been recognized in the law since the 1980s, and the medical professions have developed clinical criteria for measuring and assessing brain death. And there's tests that are developed for adults by the American Academy of Neurology, and there's tests and measures that are developed for children developed by the American Academy of Pediatrics.
So for the family, when their loved one appears alive, the idea that they are dead, brain dead, is sometimes unbearable. They don't want the medical staff to take that away from them. What rights does a family have in a situation like that?
So these cases are asking a new question that hasn't been asked much historically. So normally, once a patient has been determined dead, and brain death in Michigan is legal death, you really don't have any rights because normally, you don't have rights to control healthcare decisions for somebody who's dead. What they're doing, of course, is contesting the fact about whether or not they actually are dead. And secondly, at least in the current case, the Titus Cromer case, which is still active in the courts, they're also contesting the very legitimacy of brain death.
Lawsuits have been filed against medical institutions before dealing with things like this. Generally speaking, what's the legal history of those kinds of suits?
So in the last 5 years, there have been a lot of lawsuits from coast to coast making arguments that you can't even do the tests without our consent, arguments that you have to honor our religious objections to brain death. We don't believe in brain death. Therefore, the patient's not dead until there's heart criteria. Generally, these suits have actually had some mixed success. And perhaps the most interesting of the claims, and this is, I think, in the Titus Cromer case, is the statute in the state of Michigan says you're not dead until there is irreversible cessation of all functions of the entire brain. And the medical community has basically conceded that they don't measure the cessation of all functions of the entire brain. They measure the cessation of most of the functions that they think are significant. So there is a gap between what the medical profession is doing on the one hand and what the law requires on the other hand.
So the doctors you're saying are looking at the higher brain functions, but if they happen to be still breathing or there happen to be a heartbeat, that's in part a brain activity. It's a lower brain activity.
Well, it's not so much higher versus lower. Brain death does require that it's not just that the higher part of the brain, but also the brain stem also has to be dead. But what specifically has been excluded has been hormonal functions, which are controlled by the pituitary gland and the hypothalamus, which are parts of the brain. And the medical profession has said, well, we don't count those. Those don't matter. And the problem is that the law hasn't carved those out and says that it's all functions of the entire brain that needs to be stopped until there's death.
If you would, and I know this is a big ask, but just give us the different perspectives quickly of the medical community, family members, religious beliefs, and so on.
So until 1968, there wasn't really a thing, a concept of brain death. So it's still relatively new, but it's been well settled for decades. So the medical profession is in pretty solid consensus that brain death is death. And the way in which we assess brain death, and that's legal death. And it's very important to note that one reason why brain death is important is because that's how we obtain most of the organs that we use for transplantation, right? So we have a large waiting list of people waiting for organs, about 115,000 people on the waiting list, but we only got 35,000 organs last year, right? If we challenge and we reduce public trust and confidence in brain death, then the organ donation rate may go even further down than it already is. So that's the medical profession's perspective. On the family side, I think usually what's being contested is the diagnosis itself. It's a hard diagnosis to accept because the patient is still on mechanical ventilation, which means they look warm, they look like they're breathing, their skin is pink. So intuitively, it doesn't look like they're dead. And of course, especially in a pediatric case, it's hard for a parent to accept that diagnosis in any case. You're just going to be in denial. There is a misdiagnosis rate, unfortunately. So the medical literature does show that clinicians that perform brain death tests do it in variable ways. So the way one Detroit hospital does it might be different than the way a different Detroit hospital does it. This is all documented in peer-reviewed medical literature. So therefore, there is sort of a basis for parents to be a little mistrustful that the tests were accurately performed.
Is our understanding of what it means to be dead evolving?
Well, here's the thing is, what seems to be clear is that it's an arbitrary line. We decided in the 80s when the 1968 rule was really getting codified into law, that we drew a line and said, that's death, that's legal death. But it could have been drawn to the left and it could have been drawn to the right. So it's a little bit arbitrary. And I think the one thing that's sure is that legal death and medical brain death does not correspond to what you might call biological death. Right. We know that people who are dead, brain dead, like Titus Cromer and Bobby Reyes, their bodies can still do things. Right. They can still mount a stress response if you cut them. And there's a range of functions. We know that there's brain dead pregnant women who can still gestate a fetus. Right. So there's a difference between being medically dead, legally dead and being biologically dead. And so I guess what some people are pushing is saying we need to redraw where that line is.
Is there a clear vision about how all of this is going to be resolved?
I don't think there is a clear vision. I think there was a very high profile case, the Jahi McMath case, which kind of lasted between 2013 and 2018, which got enormous media attention. And I think that it's only because of that case that only in the last 5 years have we really started to focus and recognize that there are gaps between the law and medicine on this issue. And there are unresolved issues. Some states grant patients a religious objection. Some states do not. So we recognize that there's gaps. We recognize that there's variability in how these issues are treated from state to state. And so I don't think there is a clear vision yet, because it's really only in the last few years that these issues have really become apparent and recognized.
Thaddeus Mason Pope is the director of the Health Law Institute at Mitchell Hamlin School of Law in St. Paul, Minnesota. Thanks for helping us better understand this.
Thank you.